Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Virtually Speaking Science. It is Wednesday, June 24th, 2015. We are hosted in Second Life by the Exploratorium, where we are joined by a digitally present studio audience who comment and pose questions in real time. Many of the books discussed in our hour-long podcast can be found online in the Virtually Speaking collection at exploratorium.edu. Today's host is Kelly Hills, ethicist, professional editor, and writer in the medical sciences and humanities. Kelly publishes her ethics-focused commentaries, where she considers the ethical, legal, and social implications of emerging technologies, DIY biotech, clinical medicine, and public health, first and most frequently on life as an extreme sport. Today, Kelly talks with Dr. Kaberi Kaur Gupta, principal scientist of the Urban Slender Loris Project, where citizens and scientists learn about this small nocturnal primate found only in Sri Lanka and southern India in order to figure out how urban coexistence might be possible. And with that, we are over to you, Kelly.
Good evening, everyone. It's really nice to be back at Virtually Speaking Science. Had a little bit of a break, mostly because I was out of the country for a little bit, but I'm really happy to be back in Philadelphia and nice warm weather finally. We had a massive storm blow through last night, but it's beautiful today. And it's a fantastic night to be talking about urban ecology at Slender Slow Lorises and my guest's work. And thank you so much for being here tonight, Kaberi. Hi.
Hi, how are you, Kelly? Thank you for inviting me to talk.
Doing pretty good tonight. I'm really interested in your project. So I made a mistake this morning. I was tweeting before coffee, which unfortunately happens more often than it should, and I mentioned that you were going to be on the show tonight and that you would be talking about the slow loris, not the slender loris. So can you explain to us really simplistically, for those of us who, you know, don't have fancy biology degrees and haven't had a chance to cuddle one of these up close, what are the difference between these two lorises?
Well, yeah, it's pretty simple. No problem at all, Kelly. Slow lorises are about a kilogram, so you how much it would be in pounds. So a couple of pounds found in the rainforests of Northeast India and Southeast Asia, whereas slender lorises weighs about less than 200 grams, a few ounces, and they are found in southern India and Sri Lanka, but in more in the dry forest than in the rainforest. So these are the two basic differences. But also, they are genetically different species. They are both nocturnal arboreal primate, and they are like they're closely related to bush babies. But that they both insects at night and also some fruits. They carry their infants when they are really small, but after a while they start what we call parking their infants. So they can't carry them as soon as the infant becomes bigger. But interestingly, these animals, being primates, even though they are small, they actually nurse their infants for a long period of time. So when mothers get tired of carrying them, then they start what we call parking them. They would park these infants in one place in a relatively safe areas. and then they will, the mother will come occasionally and nurse them and then go away and forage.
So how long?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So for those of you who are like me and were raised in a system of measurement that pretty much nobody else in the world uses, a pound is roughly 0.45 kilograms, just so American audience knows roughly what size we're talking about. So we're talking the slender loris, and it's
really
it seems like
a couple of ounces, a few ounces.
Yeah. That's tiny.
They are, yeah.
So you say that, you know, they don't carry the babies for too long. You know, they park the babies after they get to a certain size. How long does it take the babies to get to that size of parking, and how long do they nurse after being parked?
They can reach the size. It takes about a few weeks, like 5 or 6 weeks, and after that, the mother parks them, and we have seen in the wild the mother parks the infants for at least, you know, for total of 3 to 4 months. So, so it's a pretty long time, and the gestation period is really long. It's about 166 days, so it's what, 5 or 6 months.
That's almost half a year. That's getting really close to human gestation length. That's a long time for a tiny critter. Do they have a long lifespan to account for this?
Hello?
Do they have a long lifespan?
Yeah, they do have a long lifespan. Well, we don't know about lifespan in the wild, but in captivity... Can you hear me?
Oops. Oh, here we go. Now we can hear you.
Sorry.
No worries. So I think we cut out. We don't know how long their lifespan is in the wild.
In captivity, we don't know in the wild what their lifespan is, but in captivity, they last about between 10 and 15 years. So it's relatively long lifespan for a small animal of that size.
So we're talking basically... An animal the size of, at most, a small rabbit or a large guinea pig, but with the lifespan of a cat or a dog?
More like a squirrel without a tail.
Okay, I guess a tailless squirrel, so a really tiny animal that has the lifespan, though, of a cat or a dog.
Yeah,
that seems
unusual
for a small critter. That seems really
odd. That's mainly because they are primates, so their life cycle or life history patterns are very similar to other primates. So that's why they do have a long lifespan. But they're also evolutionarily in much more. I won't say the word primitive, but basically they're more, they appeared much before any of the monkeys appeared. So lorises and lemurs are, that's why, you know, classified sort of together at the bottom of a primate evolutionary tree.
So they're further back along the tree than a lot of other primates?
Yeah, they're more what we call ancestral in evolutionary biology. The other interesting thing that I haven't yet mentioned is that these animals are what we call solitary foragers. So they don't live in groups like other monkeys or chimpanzees, great apes. They forage separately. They forage solitarily. And a male and a female, adult male and female may be nearby. But a lot of times a male may have its own territory and a female may have its own territory. But if they're a mating pair or a partner, then they might share the range. They might have overlapping ranges. But otherwise they sleep independently. If the female has an infant or if the female has a mating partner, or even a, you know, a baby from last year, they might slip together in a sort of a family unit. Interesting lifestyle, interesting biology also, because lorises, slender loris especially, the males show three different kinds of home ranges. So okay. There will be a male who has really large home range, and what I found, this is what I found my PhD work, when I call them a roaming uh-huh. male, so they would roam around over large range, and you know, they may have home range may cover multiple males and females' territories, but then you will have males who are totally overlapping with another female, and then uh-huh. you will have another type of male who is sort of, you know, made a home range or territory next to a female's range, but not yet partnered with that female. So it's sort of like hanging out, waiting for a female to, you know, come and say hello, and if the other male move away, then he probably will have a chance to come and, you know, take over the territory of the female. The only right. thing is that we do not know a whole lot of stuff. Oh, this is a study that came out with radio telemetry. But in terms of how successful these partner males are with their females in terms of having infants, we don't know. Or you know, genetic success rate, we don't mm-hmm. know.
Two questions. Yeah. Kind of arise from this, and I think I'm going to chase the one that will probably be answered faster than the other one. So the first question I have from that is, and this is largely based on their size, but also their longevity. Does this mean that there is trade for them as illegal pets? Are they part of that market, or have they escaped it?
They do. They are part of the illegal pet trade, and actually more often you would see slow lorises are mm-hmm. found in the market right now, but occasionally you will hear slender lorises are being paired. In fact, there are some videos that had gone viral a couple of years ago about slow loris being used as pets, and I don't mm-hmm. remember who that was, some Hollywood movie star or somebody was showing a loris video, a slow loris video. So mm-hmm. yeah, there is pet trade. But also these animals are lorises, especially slenders, are quite interesting because they're arboreal. Not only they're mm-hmm. nocturnal, but they're arboreal too. So it's really difficult to catch them at night. And I am not sure how on earth the illegal poachers or pet traders catch them at night or during the daytime.
Okay. And that's not an encouragement for anybody to go get one, because these guys belong in their natural habitat.
No.
Not in your bedroom.
It's what we call Schedule 1 animal. So it's in the endangered species list mm-hmm. for India. Even though IUCN doesn't recognize it as an endangered species, but certainly it is an endemic, and it's an endangered species according to Indian Wildlife Act. So trading is illegal, and you don't really want to have them as a pet in your house. I mean, you know, even though we hear people used to have them as like pets, or have them as a little creature at home, but it's not the best thing to do. But also
right.
the other thing I should mention that in India, especially in rural southern India, there are some black magic or some kind of, you know, superstitious stuff that people use slender loris for black magic. Again, we don't really know how much of it goes in black magic. There is no baseline data on that, but
mm-hmm.
yeah, they do use for black magic or voodoo magic in certain parts of rural India.
Right. Yeah, I've heard that about all of the kind of ancestral primates, especially the ones with either really long fingers or the really big eyes that are nocturnal, that they tend to be used in ritual medicines or black magics in whatever area they're in, whether it's Madagascar or India or anything
or
like
Africa
that.
Or,
So I guess that kind of leads to the other question I had, which was you mentioned ranges, and it sounded like from what you were saying then that whether or not a male slender loris has a settled range or he's still roaming, it doesn't sound like they overlap ranges. Am I understanding that males don't share territory?
The roaming males do share territories with others. So they don't really actively defend their territories like the other males or females. But, you know, they would be sort of roaming in large areas. They might cover, one individual territory one day, and then a few days later you will find it in another area. So that's interesting.
So he's roaming, so he's not really a threat to the territory of the male.
Home. Could be. They also could be what we call sneak males that are, you know, maybe very weak and do not have a real territory or can't compete with a female. So they're pushed to the edge of the habitats or stuff like that. We still need to investigate that, you know. We don't really know much about them from the wild in terms of their behavior.
So if we don't know a lot about them from the wild, which makes sense, you know, it blows my mind. I was reading something this morning on entomology, actually, and how that's a great place to get people started for loving nature, because you can literally go out in your backyard and have a pretty good chance of discovering something new, just because we barely know anything about the vast majority of insects on the planet, which that blows my mind. And I know that it's similar for a lot of species, including apparently the slender loris. So we don't know a lot about them. Most of what we know is from captured animals. How in the world did you get interested in investigating their urban life? I mean, what made you decide to spend the last 15 odd years of your life?
I started like all the other ecologists. I started studying them in the forest, and the reason that I actually started working on them was also kind of coincidental. I was, after my master's, I was looking for, trying to figure out what I should do my PhD on. And I was also helping my husband Madhu for his field work. And we were in this site where they have slender loris, and I was thinking of studying primate behavior because that's what I did for my master's, and I was always fascinated by non-human primate behaviors. So the park manager, it was a tiger reserve. So, you know, we were in the tiger reserve and staying there for a while, and the park manager comes to me and say that, you know, we have some money we would like to give you would you like to start slender loris project. And the fact that, you know, we knew that there are slender lorises there, but there was no studies on them in the wild. And I said, yeah, I will do it. So that's how it started. But when I started the study, going out in the forest at night with field assistants who are local people living in the forest, and they know about slender loris, but they never really gone out at night looking for them. And we had a friend who was visiting us at the time who did his PhD in the 70s in the same forest. And he is the one who said, hey, yeah, you should do it. So he's also a primatologist. And so we went out at night for more than a month, you know, trying to look for a loris and just couldn't find any. And then the same primatologist friend came back to Finland and said, "Oh, Kaveri, you are wasting your time. There are no lorises here. They have all gone extinct locally." You know, being very discouraged. But then all of a sudden, one day, one fine night, we started, you know, finding them. And it all basically relied on how you look for them and how the searching mm-hmm. is. We were carrying a flashlight, sort of, holding it in front of us and walking in the forest. And that doesn't give you you can't see a loris like that. The way you can spot a loris at night is basically you have to keep the source of your light as close as possible to your eyes. So the reflection of the loris eyes comes to your eyes best when the headlamp, when you are using a headlamp or a flashlight holding right next to your eye and walking in mm-hmm. the forest. Very, very slowly. And once your search image is ready and you have a proper, you know, flashlight or a headlamp holding it correctly, then you can find them. You can spot them at night. So that's how it started. You know, we looked at distribution pattern and habitats. But I was not sure whether I could actually do it for a PhD. And then I got a fellowship through World Bank to study them before I came to do my PhD. So I did it for a couple of years, you know, along with lots of other stuff as a park biologist. Then mm-hmm. I came to U.S. for my PhD, went back to do my field work, and at the end I ended up doing radio telemetry to figure out the behavioral ecology of lorises, you know. So that's all. In a nutshell, my PhD.
Yeah.
So it took me a long time. But from that, I sort of took a few years off and had kids and worked as a teaching faculty in university here. Decided to go back and do some more study and wondering, you know, what and how we should do, given that I have kids. I can't just go back and live in the forest for an entire year with kids and, you know.
I was going to say, I did live there with
my older one when she was a year old, and we did for 1.5 years. But just the idea of staying there for a year with, you know, 10-year-old kid who is in school was not very visible. And meanwhile, I moved to do urban ecology here in Fresno. And a few years ago, when I was visiting Bangalore, and, you know, some of my friends were saying that, you know, we have lorises, especially in the Indian Institute of Science campus, and said, oh, yeah, we should look into it. And several of our faculty friends there said, you know, you should start loris study here in the city. And that's how sort of it came into my mind, and I realized that if you'd like to do any kind of conservation work in urban ecology, or even in, you know, regular nature conservation in protected area, the best way to do it would be involving citizens to do any kind of conservation, because I feel that, you know, community involvement is really important for long-term conservation. And so I decided to come up with a study that could involve citizen scientists. And, in 2013, we went back for a few months. We did looked at a couple of studies, a couple of areas. Then I got some grants and went back in 2014 to develop this citizen science project on urban lorises and figure out, you know, where they are in the city.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you were. I guess two things here. One, I think doing field research with a baby is just badass. We need to hear more stories of people doing that too, because we always hear about, you know, the baby track dropping women out of science. It's a huge concern in STEM, and I absolutely love, I'm actually, I think, pretty sure the first photo I ever saw of you was you with a headlamp on holding your daughter as you're in the forest looking up for a slender loris, and I think that's such an amazingly fantastic role model image. You know, you don't have to have children stop you from doing your what you want to study in research and STEM. Bring it along. Why not? If you can go into the forest and do that with a baby, I think a lot of people could probably, with support of spouses, and I have to say your husband is wonderful.
That's true.
He's a really great guy.
I think, it's possible without support of family and your spouse. And in my case, it was also my parents and siblings who were very, very supportive of my studies.
It sounds like you had a great social network in place, and I think that highlights what a lot of people have said about the necessity of having those in place for anybody who wants to do, you know, a PhD doctoral level career in STEM and also have a family and have something resembling maybe a normal life.
Yeah.
But
well, I think
on the other hand,
slow down. It having having a baby and, you know, kids, and I had both kids during the middle of my PhD, or in one in the middle and another towards the end. And it slow me down, but it's not impossible to do it. I think it's possible to do it with, and I know, as I say, that it requires the global village help to do what you want to do if you want to do it with kids. And you know, it's getting tougher. It does get tougher, but it's possible to do it.
Yeah, no, I think that's a. I think it's a really cool thing. Just it was so striking the first time I saw that picture that I know I pestered your husband about it, because I was like, what's going on here? Wait a minute! And you know, he explained to me, and it was really cool. The other thing that I think is really neat about go ahead.
I was there in that field site for a long time, so what has happened as a result of that is that I knew all the local villagers. I knew the indigenous people, and when I went back with my child, I was not afraid of leaving the kid with them. You know, I think that's an important part of, if you want to take your child in field and do the field work, you have to trust your, you know, assistants. You have to have a good understanding of what you want to do with your child. So if you are overprotective mother, then it's really not possible.
Well, yeah, it sounds like you had a good working relationship, which of course is always important. The other thing that you said was really interesting, I just don't know. I think for me, maybe it's my American perspective, because I know I don't see squirrels, for example, as like this fantastically awesome wildlife creature that thrives in an urban environment. I don't look at raccoons and go, ooh, or even possums, you know. But my Australian husband, on the other hand, every time he sees a squirrel, he's like that dog from Up, right? He's like, squirrel, squirrel, and it's so exciting. And I know when I travel overseas, you know, whether when I was in Costa Rica, I would be like, monkey, and just everything would stop because, oh my God, there was something so cool in the middle of the urban environment. I guess that kind of thing, I've never really considered it, really, that must be a huge impediment to conservation efforts, especially working with locals, is how do you get the locals to see beyond what they're so accustomed to. It's boring to see what is so magical to people who aren't there. And I guess, have you had that issue working in Bangalore? Do people understand, like, this is an important thing? We need to conserve open and green spaces so that these guys can have their territory and they can flourish?
Yeah, I think Bangalore is an amazing place. I should give you a little bit of history. I think a lot of you, the listeners are probably familiar or heard the name Bangalore because it's the equivalent of Silicon Valley and any of the tech support that you need to do these days on the phone, it goes to Bangalore. So if Bangalore used to be a sleepy little town. It used to be called Garden City of India because it is about at 3,000 feet altitude. It never used to get hot and very mild weather throughout the year. And it has a very nice, you know, many academic institutions as well as Indian Army and Air Force bases. So it is a fantastic green cover for a long period of time, both during the British or even before the British, the kings of province. They did a lot of planting, and they also did a lot for education of local people and stuff like that. So Bangalore had this, you know, avenue that were, you know, close to 1,000 years old. You know, beautiful canopy, beautiful, nicely laid, areas with where people live. And also you had, you know, very crowded, some of the areas were kind of, you know, low-income areas were crowded. But it never really had any slums like what you would see in Bombay or Delhi and Calcutta. So this beautiful city, you know, after post-globalization in the 1990s, it sort of became all of a sudden a big city, international city with Indian Silicon became Indian Silicon Valley. So as a result, what happened in the last 20 or so years, or even more like 15 years, Bangalore has been going through really rapid changes. And the change is so fast that people cannot even, you know, the local residents of Bangalore cannot even imagine, you know, or cannot even think, cannot even cope. You know, I spoke so many people and what do they think about this change, and they're like, oh, it's incredible, it's too bad, you know, we don't like it. The temperature has gone up, Bangalore has become hot, there is no green space or hardly any green space. So people have been really complaining about the city's growth, you know, and it's very unplanned. A lot of places it's very unplanned growth. Imagine Bangalore wants to be Southern California, you know, you have green grasses and palm trees. So local people didn't want it. A lot of people are really into, you know, local urban conservation. What can we do to save trees? Bangalore recently, last couple of years, they have this thing called tree festivals. And, you know, the interesting part of it is that Bangalore also has a lot of money, because IT industry professionals paid an American salary. So it's a lot of money, a lot of affluence.
Right. That's something I don't think that most Americans would think of when they think of Bangalore. I don't think they would think of affluence or anything. I know for myself, besides Indian Silicon Valley, as it were, I normally think of factories, clothing factories, manufacturing.
That's the thing. I think, somebody was telling me this morning that, I think of Bangalore as having a lot of factories. And I said, no, Bangalore doesn't have really much of industry, you know, IT industry.
Right.
I mean, not in terms of factories, but it's IT industry. So it's a tech place. In fact, you know, there is a neighborhood in Bangalore that actually, when we were driving through a couple of years ago, it felt like Fifth Avenue in New York City. So,
wow.
It's that plush and posh. With IT professionals, you have money, you can purchase equipment, have lots of big lenses. So that actually had a lot of people who are going out to do photography. Wanting to do they can do. And I think I sort of tapped that resource. What I did is, back in November 2014, I spent first two months actually, just, you know, organizing people, making, talking to people, asking people to come and, you know, what do they think about Loris Project? And so we started with a small group of academics and naturalists and, you know, volunteers. And then I, you know, announced this training program. So we already had an online survey that people are putting information in for 1 year. And then through that survey, we started doing the Loris training program in the Indian Institute of Science campus. Actually has a huge Loris population. It's 100-acre of land with a really big, large Loris population. So, you know, as we started training, people, I mean, I got overwhelming response of training. Even now, we are getting overwhelming response from people wanting to come and volunteer at night. So imagine, you know, finding an animal which is nocturnal, tiny, arboreal animal that you have to go, all you know about this animal that you have to go all the way to the forest to see them. Mm-hmm. You know, so wanting to see, you know, see them in the forest versus if you can just walk into your neighborhood and can find them, that's a really interesting thing. And people, you know, also are very much into wanting to save their whatever forest left.
That's interesting because I grew up in Silicon Valley. Actually, I'm a child of the Bay Area. Only I grew up there before Silicon Valley was Silicon Valley. I'm a child of the '80s, so I remember Silicon Valley when it was full of apple orchards and horse farms and all of these, you know, things that had been in place. You know, they weren't necessarily natural ecological landscapes, but they'd certainly been there for 100-odd years at that point, because that's what people were doing with that part of California. And I remember when Silicon Valley started, and I've gone back relatively recently in the last couple of years, and it's considerably worse than it was when I left in, when did I leave? 99-ish, 98. No, I must have left in 96. Seven-ish. Anyhow, when I left, it was basically like paved everything. If it wasn't one particular farm that had been set aside for not being paved, or if it wasn't, you know, a park, a city park or something like that, all the apple orchards were gone, all the horse farms were gone, everything was gone. It was just like somebody went through, bulldozed everything, and came right behind with a concrete layer. So it's fascinating to me that the response seems to be so completely different in Bangalore, which is, yes, great tech, awesome industry. Hey, hang on just a second. We kind of like our green spaces and the critters that live within them. Do you think it's just because people have kind of have the example of the Bay Area to be like, I don't know if we want to destroy everything? Or do you think people are just a little bit better about being aware of ecology in general and how it affects us?
I think a combination of both. I think people know about how Bay Area is. So I know a lot of people like the area, but also the, you know, the area has some conservation effort, and overall California has some conservation effort. It's a combination of that, having trees cut down in your neighborhood, or, you know, the parks cut down. One of the major problems also in Bangalore that's been happening is the reclamation of the lakes. Bangalore had a huge number of lakes, you know, and over the years, of course, much before it became Silicon Valley, but, you know, people started closing down lakes and building houses, building neighborhoods. And it sort of became, the growth became faster with the Silicon Valley, so things changed drastically, and that made people to say, okay, you know, we need to do something about it. And I'm not sure whether everybody is successful of what they want to do, but certainly there is a lot more going on and look. And it helps when you have academic institutions, you have trained people, you have scientists who are working on these issues. So it does. So it's a combination of affluency, energy of youth, and the local being your town.
So how do you go about setting up a citizen science project with citizens of urban Bangalore to look at, the urban population of slender lorises when you're in California? So how are you doing
very
this?
Very good question. The key goes to the entire urban slender lorises project team, the core volunteers as well as the other volunteers who show up twice a week to do the survey or pick up their work on their own in their spare time. And imagine, Bangalore has been a big city, has become a big city with tons of cars, but roads are not, they cannot hold the traffic. So there is a lot of traffic issues. And sometimes, I have had volunteers coming for training that they have to be in, local buses for 4 hours at a time.
Wow.
In each way. So that's kind of a commitment, and I am so lucky and amazed by the commitment of people that wanting to do things. And so what I did is I spent an enormous 4 months not doing anything other than focusing on developing this group. Very interesting. Part and the major success, I think, is that I was able to bring together, naturalists and, ecologists and photographers and regular, urban wildlife enthusiasts, IT technicians, everybody together under one umbrella in that. And even students, I must say, we have at least 4 or 5 people who are under 25 years of age. They are either working or, studying or in between master's and PhD. I think the youngest one we have so far is a 20-year-old lady who just finished her undergrad and working with us right now. So it's, I don't know. This motivation, it's this wanting to do things, it's wanting to do something for nature in your own backyard that sort of made them to, be together. And we have fantastic people, managers. One of our coordinators, she worked as a office administrator for 14 years, and she's now a full-time. She has her own. She works almost time with me with the project. So lot of these, and it's a multiple people of work,
Mm-hmm.
Lot of people are putting time in the project.
How many? You were over there.
And I did meet them once a week. I started in 2014. We do meet with them once a week,
right.
At least once a week through Skype. And then every morning I spend talking to somebody or the other about the research project on the phone, on WhatsApp. We have a WhatsApp group. I'm not sure mm-hmm. whether people are familiar with the WhatsApp in this country, but WhatsApp is a very popular
right.
messaging service app in India and other countries. So
mm-hmm.
we have a WhatsApp group. We communicate through that. We communicate through
wow.
Google, we communicate through Skype, we communicate through phone. So, pretty much every
mm-hmm.
mode of internet-based communication that you can do, we do it.
Wow,
so we
that's
are pretty tight-knit
cool.
group. We are really
mm-hmm.
very tight-knit group.
So you were over there for a while in 2014. How long were you over there?
I'm sorry?
How many months were you over in Bangalore?
I was in Bangalore for 4 months. Wow. I spent exactly 4 months there.
Is that the normal length of time that you spend over for field work?
No, depends on how you are doing it and what, you know, what you do. With Sandalore, if you are doing a field study, you probably would stay there for longer. I couldn't stay longer, even though I wish I could, but my kids were here, you know, my husband was being the single parent for a long time, and then I actually had to spend some time with my octogenarian father, so I spent in India about 6 months before I came back, so that's quite a bit of time, except that, you know, I wish I could go back again, and people are asking me when I'm going back. The other thing is also what had helped is that, you know, people of our parents' generation, they knew about lorises. In fact, even some of our friends who grew up in Bangalore knew that lorises are found in the city. So I'll give you an example, which was, I thought it was fascinating. One day, there is a sort of pub slash cafe slash restaurant in Bangalore, which is like a hub of all the intellectuals and everybody in the city, at the center of the city. It's like 78 or 80 years old. And one day I went there to meet with one of our friends, and the current owner of the pub restaurant comes, and it turned out that the local naturalist knew about him, that he's a nature enthusiast, naturalist, and wildlife rescuer. And so we started talking about this project that, you know, we're starting this project. And then he said, Kaveri, I had 5 or 6 lorises when I was growing up as a kid, but I haven't seen them since then. I thought they had gone extinct locally. So he was so taken aback by the whole idea that we can actually find lorises in the city and we can actually do a study, you know, for conservation and biology. So he gave a lot of support. He said, why don't you come and give a talk here? So I gave a talk. A lot of people came in. And, you know, then I gave a talk in one of the major IT industry there. And, again, a lot of people came in. That's how we got a lot of volunteers. So there's a lot of support even from the businesses. So this gentleman, he gave us money for printing out posters. And we go and have meetings in his restaurant whenever we want or whenever we need. But that restaurant is kind of noisy on weekends. So one of his friends said, hey, you know, you can have a meeting in my son's new ice cream parlor. You know, and this is like really fancy place. So we go there and we you know, use their Wi-Fi and have meetings there. And then, you know, he gives us some discount, and he says that's his contribution to the project. So it's kind of a lot of support that we are getting. And, you know, media picked up the story. So all the major newspapers covered the story. Those radios covered, local FM radio channels covered the story. So there is a lot of, and I think having a news in all medias helped us also getting some publicity.
Imagine it did. Speaking of publicity, you guys do have a website. I have been mentioning it to the folks in the chat room because we've been talking about it. But let me see if I've got that URL right.
We are actually updating the website right now. We're revamping. We had sort of what my IT friend called it a hackathon, you know, trying to come up with what are the things that we need to put in there and how we should do it. We also have a Facebook page, and we have a Tumblr blog, and you can find the monthly newsletter in there. So if you want updates, quicker updates, either you can follow us in Facebook or in our blog and
right.
Look for
so
newsletter.
Let's see if I can get this right. The Facebook, the Twitter account is Urban Loris.
Yes.
And the webpage, which is undergoing revisions, but it will be better than ever soon. And we all know that with websites, they're really always under revision. That's www.urbanslenderlorisproject.org. So urbanslenderlorisproject.org. And there is some good information there. And what is your Facebook page?
Page is actually right now called Urban Slender Lorises of Bangalore. But I probably should change it to Urban Loris Project. But yeah, if you do Urban Loris Project, then you will find the Facebook page.
Okay. And you should be able to, from the Facebook page, find the Tumblr and basically everything else?
Yeah, yes. There is an old website also. Sometimes people might go to that page. But the new page is urbanslenderlorisproject.org.
Mm-hmm. So is there anything that people who aren't in Bangalore can do to help support your project?
Well, the main thing that we are really looking for right now is funding. So we are hopefully soon, probably in the second week of July, we are going to launch a crowdfunding for the Loris Project. So we would love to have, you know, listeners to support us in the crowdfunding effort.
Mm-hmm.
And also, if anybody is interested, you know, getting more information about Lorises, or we are trying to get some funding through Earthwatch. So if Earthwatch is would give us money or approve our grant proposal, then if you are interested in coming down to Bangalore, looking at urban lorises and urban biodiversity, you are welcome to, you know, come and help us in the project. The other thing that we also are doing right now, we are developing, so the idea is to not just look at lorises, but also look at loris, use loris as one of the flagship species to look at urban biodiversity. So we are doing a vegetation study, how those habitats are, both for lorises and for other species. We are also trying to start a project on, you know, bird diversity, arthropod diversity, and mammal diversity. We are collaborating with local academics who are already doing research on, for example, amphibians of the city and trees, and as well as socioeconomics of the city dwellers. So it's a big collaborative effort that will hopefully, you know, go much more long term than just a short term, you know, 4 months project. So that's the whole idea.
That sounds fascinating. And I know, at least for me, and I'm going to assume a lot of our listeners, because I talk to a lot of our listeners on a pretty frequent basis, that this idea of being able to go somewhere else and learn about the environment, the ecology, the critters, and to participate and help out somehow is just awesome. I have my eye on Australia because I love wombats, and you can go on a wild wombat muster. You can, like, basically capture wild wombats and help relocate them and do science and stuff. And I'm looking at that, and I am counting my pennies to be able – it costs – what to me seems like an amazing amount of money to do it. But on the other hand, I get to run in the outback and capture wombats and snuggle them and then put them in a bag and, you know, do science to them. And I can imagine the idea of, like, ooh, wait, I can do something similar with lorises? Really? That sounds intriguing. And I know our mutual friend David Schiffman, they have a great time bringing people out onto their boat to do shark studies down in Miami, and I think that's just great. I mean, that seems like such a fantastic way for people who aren't right there to get involved too. We only have a couple of minutes left, and we have some questions from the audience, if you don't mind. the first question, and of course the burning question for, I'm sure, anybody, at least the U.S. who's listening right now, and hopefully people listening later. Folks who are listening later, I'm hoping that your local zoos will have this question. But do you happen to know if there are slender lorises in American zoos that people can go and see for themselves what these cute little critters look like?
Yeah, there used to be few other zoos. I think Philly Zoo had slender lorises at some point. I'm not sure they have it right now. But Seattle Zoo in Washington had them. Again, I'm not sure whether they have it. Duke University Primate Center has them for, but that's off exhibit. And also, San Diego Zoo has them. But I think their slender is for off exhibit. They do have slow for on exhibit.
Right. When I went to the Duke Center, I got to see. I know I saw slow lorises at Duke. I don't remember if I saw slender lorises. But you know, I was
they
so
do
excited
have
to be
in
the dark
separate room.
So maybe not. The best thing to do would be to look at your local zoo website and see if they have them. And I do know from some time I've spent with other zookeepers and stuff, if they have animals off exhibit and you're interested in seeing them, often you can work something out where, you know, it might entail a donation to the zoo or something like that. But you can actually go and see the zoo behind, the creature behind the scene. Another question from the audience. When you revamp the Urban Slow Loris website, are you planning on putting some more stories up on the lives and times of lorises so that people can have more of a maybe a narrative experience with what a loris is like?
Yes, that's the idea. And we are... part of our project to look at past distribution of lorises in the city, we are doing a oral history project. We are interviewing older generations as well as some of the indigenous communities that are living there. So we need funding for that. That's what we are sort of not gone into it in detail. I started it, but then I realized that, you know, I need to have students or people who will be able to go and do these studies on their own. So, yeah, we plan to put them on the website. We've been discussing how to do it, whether should we, put them in the Tumblr blog and then, send the link to website, because the website has a Tumblr blog, so it can be sort of a static page and updates and all these other stuff will be through the blog. And also I have recordings of interviews that I plan to put them up at some point in the website. And I'm also encouraging, there are a couple of friends I have. One of them is a journalist who used to have a loris for 6 months or so when he was a high school student. And he was telling me stories about, like, you know, we used to take them to school in our pocket, and, you know, while we were in the classroom, it would go under the desk and sleep because they sleep in the daytime.
Right.
And, it would come into our pockets back when we came back, bicycle back home. And several of our friends said that, who had pets, said that, it would go out at night through the window, forage around, because Canberra was a garden city, so had a lot of trees and people's yards were full of trees. It would forage around and come back at night during the daytime, in the early morning. So people had fascinating stories about lorises. And what I want to do is capture the stories and put them up so that, we can actually make a story of behavior of lorises that otherwise you won't get it, So that's the plan. That's the plan. We want to do it. We are trying to do it. It's a volunteer-driven project, so it takes time to do some of this stuff. But thank you for
asking. Have you ever thought do you, I guess it's a two-part question. So do you name the Lorises that you see? Do you recognize them? Do you call them by names other than, you know, Loris 123 XYZB? So do they have names and personalities for you?
No. I don't do that. You know, first of all, you know, I guess in captivity it's much easier to, you know, follow them around and be close to them and have this sort of anthropomorphic or personal relationship. But in the wild, it's really difficult to have it. So, no, when I did my PhD with radio telemetry, my radio collar tag numbers were each of these animals' names. I did not do the way, you know,
right.
And good
old. That probably, like, cuts out anything like Loris Lounge style show based on Meerkat Manor, but have you been tempted to do anything like there's this fantastic Twitter account of Mary Lee the shark, and she's actually using telemetry tracking data of Mary Lee the shark and has created a persona. And although saying this might get some of my ocean friends coming after me with, you know, tridents or whatever, I don't think sharks necessarily have much of a personality on their own. Yet, you know, apparently this is a thing now where people are actually taking the satellite tracking data of these sharks and creating personas around them as they travel up and down the coasts of America and they go to Europe and stuff like that. Have you thought about doing something similar have you ever been tempted to do something like that for a Loris?
You know, I really haven't thought about it. I guess part of my scientific brain says, oh, you can't anthropomorphize them. You know, you have to be objective. But I guess, yeah, if somebody, you know, from our core group wants to do it for, you know, education purpose or outreach purpose, I think that's a good idea to do it. But we haven't yet thought about it. But we're toying with various ideas. There was a, I think the Facebook page, if you go on today, this morning, one of our photographer friends put up, made a little video, and he put that up on Facebook page, and you can see it. It's a really little. It's not a very high quality video, but it's a little video about how, you know, it gives you some ideas about what it takes to find them at night and what exactly you see them. You don't always see a you know, really good image of a slender Loris. Sometimes, most of the time, you would see these bright lights, you know, bright eye shine. And then, you know, if you are lucky enough, you will be able to see the entire body of the animal or the animal moving away. Because they're extremely shy, so a lot of times if you have too much flashlights, they would move away. And they don't really get used to, at least in the field, they never got used to us. You know, we had radio-collared, I had about 33 radio-collared animals at one point. And, you know, some of them had collar for 4 or 5 months, and yet they never got used to us following them. So I did not get a lot of really good behavior data. It's tough to really go too close to them. So there's somebody I know who said that, oh, I can identify some Loris biologist said that I can identify slender Loris from their facial marking, and I'm like, yeah, right. You know, so and the funny thing is that she has her entire PhD thesis based on that. So I don't know. I mean, I know I later learned that she had marked those animals with some other marking. But it's really, what I'm trying to say is that it's really difficult to identify them at night unless you are really, really close to them, unless you have the animals in hand. And a lot of times even difficult to get to sex them at night when you are following them, because the females' genitalia are very similar to male genitalia. So you have to be really, I mean, I could, after handling the animals for so long, I could now, if I had a good look, I could say, okay, it's a female. But, or mm-hmm. if the baby is bulging out, I could say, okay, you know, the female is carrying. But it's really, really difficult. So I don't even, you know, tell my team members that, you know, oh, you should try to identify sex or anything. If they have
right.
Babies and they are carrying, mothers are carrying the infant, then you know that, you know, it's a female that's carrying the infant. But that's about
mm-hmm.
it. And the other problem also we do have is that in the urban areas, which I never seen in the forest, that they do get attacked by crows. And
wow.
other raptors. Yeah, so you
mm-hmm.
do find a lot of injured animals in the city. And then what you have to do is you have to call the rescuers. And these days,
mm-hmm.
in the last few months, people are calling us, the Urban Slender Loris Project group. You know, it's like, oh, we found this loris. You know, can you please come and look at it? You know, so
mm-hmm.
then one of our core team members would have to go there, find it. And in fact, right now there is at least one female with twin infants are with wildlife rescuer's house, who is actually taking care of them and waiting for the babies to mother to get better. I think mother was a little bit injured, so that
mm-hmm.
he can release them. He's a certified wildlife rescuer, and Bangalore Municipal Corporation has a team of rescuers who goes and rescue them and then rehabilitate. And then another animal was found sort of blind. He couldn't climb up the tree.
Yeah.
So you know, then you have to bring it to the rescuer, bring it to the
mm-hmm.
rehabilitation center, and this person is taking care of them. So these are the things that you would not have this kind of problem in the forest, or you would not even know,
right.
even if it is gets attacked by a raptor during the
mm-hmm.
daytime, you would not know that it's happening. So
right.
that's really interesting.
I suppose it would be, you know, any kind of social media engagement would largely have to be a very creative person utilizing their ecology and biology knowledge, you know, combined with radio tracking or anything like that, just to keep it realistic-esque. But yeah, you know, looking at the size of them and thinking about how tall the tops of trees are, I can imagine that
yeah.
unless you're Superman or something, it's really difficult to identify them in the middle of the night. But
yeah, and also
point.
Capturing them is not easy. So that's the other thing. It's
yeah.
really tough to capture them. So you have to climb trees at night to capture them. You know,
so you're good at climbing trees at night is what
I am
saying.
I am not. But my field assistants in my field site, my PhD field site, were fabulous, you know, fantastic team, fantastic support group. So they were able to climb at night and capture them. So that's all. And in fact, if we will be putting a proposal in for urban loris behavioral ecology study for radio telemetry study, but given the bureaucracy, it might take a couple of years to do that. But if we get the permission in that time, we'll have 2 years. We'll have to bring our, you know, field assistants from our field site for capturing.
Mm-hmm. So I have one final question for you, and then I think we'll be done for the night, unfortunately. And this one's a pretty simple one, and it's actually related to the whole notion of somebody climbing the tree to capture the loris. Do they bite?
Uh-huh. They do bite.
Is it hard? I mean, do they draw blood? Are they ferocious little critters?
They do, because they're insectivores, so they have very, very sharp teeth. Yes, and I did get bitten by them in my initial years of capturing them. But we do use those leather gloves, the, you know, people use for rose bushes and stuff like
yeah.
that. So long uh-huh. leather gloves to capture them. And then you get, you know, you sort of figure out a way to handle them, how you can handle them without biting. And because it's a mammal, so you have to be careful about rabies. I know one of the students from Indian Institute of Science last year got bitten. He was coming out at night from his lab, and saw these lots on the street, on the they're not very good at walking on the in the you know the
right on the ground.
Sort of she because it's an injured animal that on the road and it might get killed by a car or something. So he picking it up and the animal bit him, and so he had to then go. Get anti-shots and all sorts of other shots. I don't encourage anybody to hold them at all.
Mm-hmm.
And we did have also the permission from the Karnataka Forest Department to capture them. So we're very careful. We just do options at this point to figure out the current distribution and the habitat structure of the lorises in the urban areas. That's our one of the primary goals of this project at this point.
So just to repeat, folks, if you find a loris on the ground because you're wandering through the streets of Bangalore, because if you find one here, you've got another problem, don't pick it up. Maybe call experts. Sharp insectivores teeth. I don't know if you've ever been bitten by an insectivore before. I have, long story. It hurts. It really hurts.
It does.
They draw blood.
It does.
They're very good at getting blood draws out of you. So leave phlebotomists alone and call the experts. Just please don't call the Urban Loris Project people because they're not the wildlife experts that need to come and deal with the loris on the ground. Is there anything else you would like to inform our audience about the loris before we wrap up for the night?
I think if you are interested about lorises in Bangalore City, I think please follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Twitter is not extremely active, but Facebook is at this point. We'll see a brand new revamped page pretty soon, with a lot more information. And if you happen to, you know, see the crowdfunding effort that we are trying to do, try to donate some money if you can, because we do need it right now, especially also because we have a couple of papers that got accepted for presentation in meetings, so in conferences. So it's like, you know, we need to fund these students to get their tickets and travel and all of those things. So that's why we're kind of desperate at this point to start getting funding for the research. I did have initial little bit of grant, and that just got over while I was there. Plus also my travel to India depends on the grants. So
grant funded research is always
always
a
shooting budget. Yes.
Well, yeah, I will definitely share.
Thank you.
I'll definitely share the crowdfunding page as soon as it goes up. So those of you who follow me on Twitter will be able to find it, and it'll be on the Urban Slender Loris website and Facebook when it does go up. Thank you so much for being here.
If you have some interesting ideas, about community-based conservation, urban, conservation, email me, would like to hear from you about what you think. Also would like to hear from you when updated website goes up about what do you think about it and what kind of information you would like to have more. We would try to do that.
So those of you who had the questions and the suggestions about putting up information about lorises and their history and stories, if you have more ideas like that or more questions, it sounds like, this is a genuine citizen science project. You don't have to be in Bangalore. If you have questions or you're interested, you can contact the researchers.
Exactly.
They're really accessible, and you can shape a little bit of what's going on this website and maybe even some of the research in the future. And, of course, it's also a great opportunity to help support some students from around the world to continue pursuing their education and getting experience presenting at conferences, which, you know, in the humanities, we definitely need all the help we can get. And ecology straddles that weird border between the humanities and the sciences when you're looking especially at the urban areas where it gets all complicated with anthropology and sociology and everything else.
It's a totally interdisciplinary project in a true sense, with a true participation of, you know, citizen scientist community members. You know, it's sort of what I think of it as democratization of science, that it's really important to involve local community members, not just for data collection, but also in true sense participation in a research project. How do you do research with them? So that's the major experience that we are learning through this project.
And so I think that's great. That's just awesome. And we're also going to continue this conversation actually next month on the theme of urban ecology and environment and water with your husband, who also studies these things. So if you guys are interested in urban ecology, tune in next month, because in some ways it's going to be a to be continued, only we're going to talk about completely unrelated but field-related things. It made sense in my head when I was thinking about it, and let's just go with it. If you want to get in touch with the Urban Loris Project now, on their website, you can write to them via contact form, or you can drop them email at urbanlorisproject@gmail.com. And, of course, if you want to get in touch with me or you have any questions, or if you just find it easier to remember my Twitter username than a long email address, I am Roxa at Twitter, which is R-O-C-Z-A, and Barry is Loris's on Twitter. So it's pretty easy to find both of us on the Twitters, and we're both happy to help you with anything like that. Barry, thank you so much for being here tonight. This was really awesome and interesting, and I just really want to go cuddle a loris right now, but I'm not going to, because insectivore could have rabies. Thank you so much. This was really awesome.
Thank you, Kelly. It was great talking to you. I really enjoyed it. And again, if anybody has questions, please let us know.
Fantastic. And before we wrap up tonight, I, of course, want to say thank you to our fantastic Second Life hosts, the Exploratorium, a museum interactive experience and all-around world-changing place, at least for me, when I was growing up as a kid. And I am thrilled to be able to say thank you to them for hosting us here. And thank you to Blog Talk Radio, Second Life, my fantastic and eternally patient producer, Sherry. And I will talk to you guys all in a month here, but you can come find me on Twitter and we can talk before then. Have a fantastic evening, everyone. Good night.
Thank you.